Welcome to Breaking Good, the officially unofficial podcast for Breaking Bad on AMC. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 3, Episode 6, entitled Sunset. This is another, in my opinion, landmark moment for Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
In a couple of ways that we'll probably have to talk more about in spoilers, but I really like this episode a lot.
Well, we talked about, like, last episode was the official kickoff for kind of the new age of Breaking Bad with the Super Lab.
Uh-huh.
And I felt like this episode was underscoring that fact with the destruction of the RV.
Yes,
like,
it's there's ushering out one era.
There's no going back. That is what this is telling us. Quite effectively, I thought.
Yeah.
This was a great, another, man, season three's got, as I'm watching it, the perfect blend of the action, the drama, and the comedy. And I feel like that they get away from that in later seasons where there's increasingly less and less comedic moments, but there's so many good ones.
And I mean, I think that's warranted, you know, as the, as the danger, like, gets more real and she gets more serious, you gotta.
But it's kind of funny that they're able to maintain this many laughs per episode.
Yeah.
With just simple things like Jesse's bitches.
And they use it so sparingly now that it really works when it hits.
It really lands home. Uh-huh. And in an extremely tense moment gets one of those tense laughs out of you. So, because that's the thing. Like, some of these moments still work. Like, I know what's going to happen. And when they're both pinned in the RV, it's just so suspenseful.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get there. Is there anything we want to talk about before we
get into the recap? I've been wanting to say this for like the last billion episodes, but if you're a fan of the Mythbusters, they did their season premiere was a full-scale setup replica of, trying to think how I can say it without spoilers, a contraption involving a garage door opener.
Okay.
Let's go with that. And it actually has Vince Gilligan presiding over the full-scale test, and it's got some interesting kind of moments with him, and I thought it was just an awesome episode. So if you're a fan of that television show, or even if you're not, you're just a Breaking Bad fan, they did one like the previous season, which is kind of a bummer, because they essentially just pissed all over Breaking Bad as far as science, you know, you can't dissolve bodies like that, you can't blow up, you know, Tuco's place like that, you can't do this, you can't do that. But this one, it actually pretty much, it works just like it does on the screen, and it's pretty fucking awesome. So check that out. It's on demand or Discovery Channel.
Okay. Well, let's get into the recap. We start off with a cop driving down the road. He gets a call from dispatch telling him he needs to go check on Miss Pecatiwa?
Yeah, something like that.
Is that how you say it? He gets there. He finds the house is locked up, and there's signs that somebody's around. He goes snooping, and out by the shed, he finds her body, and he calls for backup, and then he finds the cousins there.
Yeah.
And one of them kind of distracts him while the other sneaks around and axes him in the back. I thought the moment I really like in this is when he bites into the apple, and it is timed to coincide exactly with the slash from the axe.
I liked how the initial goings of this, there's a lot of stuff, like, the fact that this is kind of shot like a horror film, you know, like the res officer like looks aside and you see like sheen, you know, and it has the kind of the horror movie minor chord, and
you can see the other cousin coming up in the background behind him while he's not paying attention,
and also just I like to take a moment to appreciate the performances of the extra level talent on this show.
Okay,
like. In a lesser show, this res cop would be, you know, perhaps cover your eyes bad.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really solid.
Yeah.
Like,
I had no problem with it.
He's just really, really, really solid. And it's, you know, I don't often notice that. I think this is the first time I've talked about it. But it's just like, I'm trying to think of a bit part that's really poorly done on this show. I mean, everybody brings their A game for it. It's pretty.
It seems like it, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know whether this is a symptom of using local ABQ talent, and they're just like, "Hey, man, this is my moment to shine." Whereas in LA, maybe your extras are not that motivated, or.
Yeah, you would think there'd be more to choose from in LA, though, right? Like,
but I mean,
you know, we got a million extras out here. We can choose the best of the best.
I mean, I've been in the hiring process. I would much rather select from a pool of five really talented and qualified candidates than 500, you know, cattle call. Because it's like you just cannot fill. You just can't.
Sure.
You can't weed through. No one has the time or effort. So maybe
you might not be able to find the people who are real good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that's, I don't know, that's my theory anyway.
Okay.
And then the cousin just goes to town chopping down that wood that is this officer, like, yeah, with the, and the sculching sounds, I guess is what you'd call it. Just,
it's pretty gross.
With the apple chomping. Pretty horrific.
I also like the very beginning, the opening shot on this this little, what do you call that? It's not an air freshener. It doesn't look like an air freshener. I mean, maybe it has probably some kind of scent.
But it's the fighting terrorists.
Yeah, Homeland Security, and then it flips over and you see the Native Americans,
sure,
there.
Sure.
I thought that was a nice little call out. I don't want to get political, but sure.
I think it's like it. You know what? If you say that Europeans coming to the Americas was good for Native Americans, then fuck you. Because
I don't know that there are people out there who think that.
If they listen to this podcast, there are people and I want to tell you personally, fuck you.
There are people out there who think we didn't go to the moon, so.
Well.
Send your emails to a.ron.
I'm not quite that up in arms about that.
At baldmove.com.
But yeah, no. That's you need to read up on some history, man.
Sure. Skyler calls Walt to talk about the divorce, and he has claimed all financial responsibility for the kids. Skyler doesn't really like that because of where the money comes from. He's like, you know what? How do you think we've been paying our bills this whole time? And she kind of doesn't really have a response for that. And he hangs up. He proceeds with renting the apartment that he's looking at.
Sure. The model.
The model. He wants the furniture. He wants everything. Corporate rental here.
I thought it was interesting. Well, not interesting, but it's pretty good at the Villigan for Skylar to say that my unhappiness came out of the blue sky.
Didn't think that was a little bacon gauntlety. I thought so. So
my question was, have they established at this point that one of the street names for Walt's product is Blue Sky?
They talk about blue. They talk about, I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe not, but in my head, of course, it's Blue Sky.
Okay. And that's one of the things, like, I guess this is maybe a minor spoiler if they haven't established that that's one of, but they call it a bunch of different things before the end of the thing. But yeah. Blue Sky is one of the trademark. I know that was one of the t-shirt design concepts that we had for our mm-hmm. Kickstarter reward level. And I thought when I, you know, on the rewatch, that just really hit me out of the blue sky. And yeah, you know, it's like, the line between bacon gauntlet and ham-fistedness and sly is subjective, but to me, it hits on the sly side of the fence.
Okay. And we also see Walt's attitude kind of changing toward things. He's at the end, he has this line, name one thing in this world that is not negotiable.
Well, and the whole concept of him, I'm going to be providing for my family, Skyler. Yeah. I mean, he's just parroting Gus's words.
Yeah, that's straight out of the Gus playbook.
Sure.
I mean, he... I don't know. It's interesting what he's turning into here.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Then we get a brief scene of the cousins showing up at Los Pollos, and Gus takes notice of that, and so does Cynthia, the manager, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
When he's not around, she's the manager.
She cares a lot more about this chicken shack than I would guess as assistant manager does.
Yeah.
Like. Those dudes, I'm not, and the manager's there, I'm not going to take it upon myself to tell them to move along. Mm-hmm. Cynthia is like, she earns that Employee of the Month spot or whatever.
Yeah.
That plaque.
Mm-hmm. Then Badger and Skinny Pete are checking out Jesse's new product at his house. And he has Badger test it out, even though he's in rehab. He says, you know, I can watch, I can cook. He's just not going to do it. Badger loves it. He starts river dancing around, and then Jesse tells him that they're going to start selling again. And then it takes a little bit of persuasion, but he promises that we're not going to get greedy this time. And so they both agree.
That's throwing shade at Walt and his business practices. Oh, of course. Practices.
Yeah, it's not going to be like it was. We don't get greedy like before. He thinks, you know, with Walt out of the picture, he can run this operation the way it should be run.
Do you think amongst junkies that it's a competition similar to the, you know, inside the comedian circle to be able to tell the aristocrats? Do you think it's a competition to describe the effects of drugs in new and novel ways? Like, is there like respect for people that can really nail the whole my brain's being boiled in a vat of anthrax?
Probably.
And where do you draw the line? Like, I feel like there's a Key and Peele skit waiting to be told about, like, a junkie that just goes over the line. They're like, oh, yeah, and then he just keeps on, and it's like, wait, this doesn't sound fun anymore. Like, boiling your brain in anthrax is already on the sweet side of cool, but then...
It's like someone took out my kidneys and rolled it between their teeth.
Right.
Like, what?
Right.
What, dude?
Right. It's like a pit bull is chomping on my testicles. I don't know if I want to try that. That sounds like a bad trip.
Count me out. Yeah. And I think it's also funny that he's like, okay, get the oil changed, get the fluids checked, get the brake lights done. And then he's like, put the fucking buzzer in the thing because 4 days out is not going to happen again. Or
I don't got a guy to build a robot for me no more. Can't have that happen.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, when he is throwing shade at Walt for like not getting greedy.
Yeah.
To also mention the thing that he screws up in that scene with 4 days out is kind of like a yin and yang sort of thing where like they're both kind of at fault and you get the feeling that this is not necessarily going to go as well as he hopes.
Oh, sure. Don't have to wait much of an episode for that, for this whole RV plan to fall apart.
Yeah, no kidding. Then we get a montage of Walt getting dressed and making this bag lunch with a sandwich with no crusts. And then on the way to school, Walt tries to talk to Junior about the divorce. Mm. And he doesn't really seem to be too thrilled, which, you know, he shouldn't really be. But Walt's trying to explain stuff, and Junior just doesn't
Junior doesn't like that he's giving up.
Yeah.
I thought it's been a while since Walt reminded me of my dad, but this Sunshine on Me Today montage, he's just such a square, man. Like, he's the kind of guy that gets ready early to where he's not even ready to leave his apartment. It's too early to leave his apartment, so he just sits in a chair and not watching television, not have a book. He's just going to sit and wait for the clock to run out, and then he's going to go. It's like, just, damn, dude. That. And again, I cannot stress, like, if you shave my dad bald, he wears the same glasses, he has the same kind of tan members-only jacket. It's uncanny. Like, my dad, when he'd get ready for the dental lab, this is what he would look like, exactly.
Hmm. All right. And really, a nice blue shirt, nice gray pants.
Yeah, middle-aged dude, chic. Yeah.
All right, yeah. How long, so let's say you're getting ready. And you get ready a little bit before you expected.
Yeah.
How many minutes is it where you find yourself in this scenario before you have to leave? Like, is it
five
minutes? Like, not long enough to actually just leave and like say, oh, well, account for traffic, and not long enough to turn on a TV, get a book.
I don't know, because I'm always running behind, not in schedule-wise, but like I always have a list of tasks, random menial tasks I can be doing. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's time to scrub out the sink, or it's time to, you know, wipe down the counters, or the kitchen needs to be swept. So it's like, I don't feel like I ever have just time to sit down and do whatever.
All right. And I imagine it's different in different places where you get like different levels of traffic.
Yeah.
Like if you live in LA, it's probably like, oh, well, I've got an hour to kill, but traffic, so I'm going to go.
That's I've never lived in a place where, you know, both Indianapolis and Cincinnati have very predictable traffic patterns that you're not, you know, if you get surprised, you can legitimately say, man, I was caught in traffic and nobody's going to be like pissed.
No, it's a wreck that causes that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Or 6 inches of snow fell in rush hour or something. it's going to be a thing.
So I really like that the windshield is replaced here. You can tell Walt's I need to replace this now. I remember what happened last time.
Yep.
Not having that happen again. And he really feels like a whole new man. You know, the stuff he's telling Junior about, like, I feel good about the future.
Yeah.
I think he does.
I think he does, too. I'm not going to be on the run from a drug dealer's anymore. I'm going to have fat stacks.
But he's also come to terms with this idea that his family is going to be what it's going to be going forward, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's not going to have a relationship with Skylar, but he wants to have a relationship with his kids. That sort of future.
What will that be? And how will Walt respond to that? Because here is Walt Jr. kind of off the whole Walt bandwagon.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just some Band-Aid bacon away from going back to Flynn, and can't have that. So, Walt, what's Walt's new story? I mean, the high road, he's kind of getting off the high road tunnel. He's starting to say, like, you know, instead of just being like, well, you know, it's your mother's an unfathomable thing and who can understand. And he's starting to, like, actually take some responsibility. And, like, I'm the man that I am and we are what it is, what it is. And we are what we are. And
yeah,
he's turning a little bit of Popeye here. The yam what I am. It's like, what is he going to do? How is he going to have that relationship with his children?
Yeah. I also think it's funny, this lunch that he makes, it's very much like he's still the teacher, right? Like he's bringing his bag lunch to work and
you're working in a fucking undercover super secret super lab.
Yeah.
You got to write your name on your lunch bag.
There's going to be maximum three people in here. Maybe
I'm saying like that's one step away from like Buzz Aldrin or Neil Armstrong doing it on the moon. Like, damn it, Buzz, did you eat my sandwich?
Again?
There ain't no one else here. The other fucker's still up in orbit. What are you doing, Buzz? Yeah, no.
He's been out on a walk forever.
Came back, there's crumbs on a spaceship. Did you eat my... I wrote Neil on the bag and everything, Buzz. What the hell?
Yeah, so Walt... Or, sorry, Gus arrives at Los Pollos to find the cousins waiting for him again. His employee notices... And they, she suggests that they call the police, but Gus says, why would we? They're doing nothing wrong.
Yeah.
Just sitting there. The only thing they're doing wrong is taking up a table, which this poor lady and will find out later.
Just genuinely looking menacing. Yeah. Menacing as hell.
Yeah. I mean, obviously something is up. Cynthia knows, but she doesn't know what.
So was Gus's plan just to ignore them all day and hope they go away?
I don't know. Because I don't know.
This seems like it takes part of the better part of the day. Like he finally gets someone to go away by saying sunset.
Yeah. Yeah, I really don't know what Gus is thinking there. Maybe he's thinking, you know what, I'm going to ignore this because they're trying to intimidate me and I'm not going to let them get the best of me.
There is a little bit of that. Like I thought it was a very interesting choreography when they got out of the booth. That, like, Gus kind of stood his ground, and I think the cousins are more inclined to, like, check someone in that situation, but they actually turn their bodies to avoid contact.
Yeah.
Like the careful layers of showing respect versus fear versus, you know...
Versus getting your point across.
In preserving machismo, like, there's it's like Gale's Perfect Coffee. It's a very delicate balance. You got to pull a vacuum, make sure it doesn't go over 92 C.
Upset the tannins.
No, hell no. No, that's volatile.
Speaking of Gale's Coffee, Walt goes to the super lab where he finds his new assistant, Gail Boddicker.
Did you notice?
Waiting for him.
Walt just valet parks that Aztec?
He does. He just rolls up and steps out.
The lights are on. You can see that the lights are on and they're actually shining on the wall.
Wow.
And maybe that's smart. Some of the laundry guys are going to park it inside or something so it can't be seen from the street.
Yeah. I mean, and if you're paying a guy $3 million, $1 million a month,
you valet parking cost is the least of that.
Yeah.
That's just a perk.
For sure.
Executive bathroom, private fridge. Those are all just
I wonder assumed. If there is a bathroom in the super lab.
Well,
I mean, you can't have Walt coming out every 20
minutes. There's an eyewash station.
So he'll just use
that. Anything's a bathroom if you're brave enough.
It's true. So Gale shows off his coffee brew setup here, which makes the best coffee Walt has ever tasted. I really like how they frame, you know, the process of brewing coffee with the process of cooking meth. Granted, coffee's a lot less harmful,
but probably more addictive.
But it's just interesting, you know, the principles are the same, right? The chemical compounds are all need to be in this delicate balance to achieve the perfect result. And that's what these guys are really good at. And so I feel like it's neat to see them doing that in all other aspects of their life as well.
Also, though, it was really interesting how Gail Boddicker's expertise is in X-ray crystallography, which if you remember back from the pilot, that was... research that Walt won. He didn't win a Nobel Prize, but he was on the research team of the two guys that did win the Nobel Prize for that.
Yeah.
So that is like right up his alley. It'd be like me going back to work in IT and I get assigned as a pair programmer to a former podcaster. It's like, what are the odds?
Sure. Yeah. And it shows that he's respected by Walt immediately, right?
Yeah, no, he feels like this guy's very impressive. Between the coffee, the X-ray crystallography, and his general, you know, demeanor, it's
and this is
made in heaven.
This is I mean, it really is. This is his dream. You know, he's working in this super lab, and you got this idealistic sort of jazz piano playing.
That's the thing. It's the most genteel cooking montage. that you will ever see in Breaking Bad. And everything, like, for the very first time, everything is just so.
Yeah, like, it fits.
They have the perfect tool to do everything. Like, even the to filter out the blue goo that eventually makes a like, that's the perfect tool to do that task.
Yeah, and he has the perfect assistant, right?
He is.
I mean, this is what he would have hoped Jesse would have become eventually.
Yeah, except for Jesse would never, because Jesse doesn't have the passion for the chemistry.
No, he doesn't.
Where this guy is geeked out about doing this for exact same reason. And to the extent that, so we're going to go ahead and, I guess, talk about this next scene where they're kind of picking each other's brain, or Gail's picking Walt's brain, number one.
Yeah.
And number two, at what point did you start thinking, or did you, that, like, this is kind of a put on? Like this from guy, yeah, like, this guy, it's just over the top. Like, his rationalization for cooking meth is identical to Walt's rationalization. His background is identical to Walt. They, you know, he's quoting Walt with, you know.
You know, I didn't feel that way.
Really?
No, because I think the reason I didn't feel that way is, A, because I think Gus sees the value of having someone who's as dedicated and as smart and well-equipped as Walt.
So on your first way through, did you take this as Gus has actually done his homework and found the perfect assistant for Walt?
Yes.
Because I just felt like it was at, like, the third or fourth detail that was just, like, perfect for Walt. It's like, man, this is a bit much.
Uh-huh.
This is like, you know, some weird science shit created in a lab for to be Walt's lab assistant. Which Gail probably could do. Gail could probably whip up the perfect Walt, you know. He could improve upon himself given enough time and coffee apparatus.
Yeah, yeah, probably. I don't know. I never felt like there was anything off here.
Okay.
It just felt like the guy was qualified, the guy was willing, and Gus wanted someone who was smart and dedicated.
Did you get that Gail is developing a bit of a crush on Walter?
You know, I think we talked about that maybe in our season four coverage.
Yeah.
As this kind of progresses. And I can see why people might think that, but it could also just be the respect they have for each other.
And I'm not saying necessarily in a sexual connotation, but just like...
Oh, okay.
You know...
Then, yeah, yeah. I totally buy that.
Okay. But also in a sexual connotation.
Okay. That I'm not sure about. But I think, yes, this kind of like... you know, crush, as you would call it, is one of respect. This is a man who has all, for all intents and purposes, won the Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm.
Gail is, I'm sure, well-read enough and into the field enough to know that. I can't imagine that he doesn't know who Walter White is.
I kind of think he does.
Yeah.
Because, like, no, I think he doesn't. I mean...
You think he doesn't?
Yeah, because, like... That was a while ago, and he's on the research team. So, like, would he know the Nobel Prize winners? Of course. But would he know down to the lab assistants from that long ago, when then he immediately went and toiled in obscurity?
I don't know. I didn't get the impression that Walt was a lab assistant.
He's also younger.
On that team.
He's also much younger than Walt. Like, 15 years?
He is, yeah.
So, like, would if he was in college while Walt was forming... you know, gray matter, and like that was in the trade journals, maybe, but I feel like it's pretty, I'm pretty skeptical that he would know. And if he did, I'm pretty sure he'd say something like, of course, I've read your papers on your development. I mean, you're the pioneer. And if he would have, I mean, it seems like every time he's got an opportunity to suck off Walt's ego, he does it.
Okay.
So that would be a good opportunity to do so.
At the very least, it seems like there is some kind of built-in respect that he has for him right off the bat. And that may just be he knows that Gus has hired this guy to run the lab, and so he must be very well qualified.
Yes.
But there's something there.
I wonder how you find a guy like Gail.
I don't know.
Is that something you put in Craigslist?
Uh-huh.
Libertarian chemist specialization in crystal.
And coffee brewing.
Yeah.
I don't know. Must be able to recite poetry.
Free thinker.
Mm-hmm.
Morally flexible. Maybe a libertarian just bakes that idea in.
Yeah, and I, you know, like I
said, kid our libertarian friends.
Don't want to get too political here, but, you know, Gail kind of lays out the case for why he's doing this as well.
Sure.
You know, consenting adults want what they want, and they'll get it somewhere. If not for me, then...
I mean, like I said, I don't think that's a radical point. That's my point of view. Like,
of course you don't think it's radical because it is your point of view.
I know.
Whereas many other people would say, that's ridiculous. We need to ban all drugs.
I get it. Feel like, yeah, if only we had had 40 or 50 years of experimental evidence to see if that policy works. If only.
Oh, God.
If only.
Oh, God. Moving on. Hank is still waiting outside Jesse's house. He's eating fast food, and he gets a call from Marie, who wants to know when he's coming home. He says, I'm not coming home until Jesse leads me to this RV. And she suggests that he call up Walt. And when he does, he asks if he knew anything about Jesse having an RV and cooking meth. And Walt is appropriately horrified by the mention of an RV meth lab.
Sure.
Do you think that Hank has slept since he found the photo of the bounty?
Man, he's... Whew, those eyes.
I think he's like 3 days into this whole operation.
Well, Marie, even when she calls later, are you ever coming home? Like, of course, Marie's the type of housewife, I think, that might trot that out on the first 24 hours. But
maybe, but I get the impression that he's been up for a good 48 to 72 hours.
Yeah, he's rocking he's looking pretty intense.
Yeah. Which all kind of, you know, feeds back into the end of this episode, which
yep.
I love so much. Then Walt calls Jesse to tell him Hank's on to him, but instead of telling him that, he hangs up because I guess he doesn't want this phone call to be connected to him.
Yeah, his brain is going in high gear, and he's like, first thing, I gotta call Jesse. Oh, wait, if he's under, you know.
Yeah, and Jesse's like, Mr. White? Mr. White? Oh, yeah, no, don't yeah, say that, man.
This is fucked up, yeah.
We need code names. Call me Heisenberg.
Yeah, exactly.
And so instead, he calls Saul to tell him what's going on, and Saul tells him, you need to get rid of that RV. ASAP. Like, Saul's flabbergasted that he didn't have a plan for this, a contingency plan. And I love the line he trots out. The Starship Enterprise had a self-destruct button.
I'm just saying. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Real good. And you know, just the state we find Saul in when Walt first calls up. He's got this leg massager going.
I was like, this foot wiggler. Yeah. So it just seems like it's a foot wiggler.
I think it's a leg massager. I think he's doing a calf massage. But
it seems like the way it does that is by wiggling your feet. Like, it just oscillates your calves at high frequency. There's no squeezing or... But, nope. You know, that's something... You didn't get that at Sharper Image. That's a SkyMall product.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and he paid probably $150
for it. And it was all capital, the foot wiggler.
So Walt steams into the lot where they're storing the RV, and he's hell-bent on getting rid of it. The mechanic knows a guy they can call, and Badger calls Jesse to tell him what's going on. And then Jesse runs out of his house, and we see Hank following him.
This is such a Rube Goldberg device, like... You know, Walt does this, Jesse comes flying out, Hank's fine. You're just like, this thing is building to a very ugly head.
Yeah, I really love this show when different people have different information.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all acting in the most appropriate way they can.
Yeah.
And it's just this orchestration of tragedy, of... Yeah. Circumstance just coming together in ways that just screw with our characters.
And that's the thing, like, Jesse just putting on his coat and walking out the door to go get a pizza would have gotten Hank like in a lather.
Yeah,
him bolting out screaming, he's got to have such a law enforcement boner that it's just like he's blacking out from the lack of blood pressure through the brain.
You can see it on his face. No, when he steps out of his car and he sees that RV, he's like,
yeah,
gotcha now.
Yeah,
I gotcha.
Yeah.
I like how Walt says, if I go down, we all go down here. Like, I don't know if that's a threat or if that's a fact.
I feel like it's a fact.
I wouldn't put it past Walt to be threatening there.
I mean, I don't, like, I feel like, yes, it is a threat, but also it's a kind of fact. Like it or not, if I go down for this, like, you're the one with the vehicle parked here. How are you going to explain that?
Yeah.
You know, accessory after the fact, I think, is the term that Skyler keeps throwing around.
Sure. So the cousins are still at Los Pollos, and Cynthia comes up to them, starts to tell them to leave, but Gus intervenes. Instead, he tells them he'll meet him at sunset.
One of the cousins speaks.
Yeah, for the first time,
Luis Moncada gets a couple lines of dialogue in this one. Mm-hmm. Pretty remarkable.
I thought that was going to be the only line they had.
Nope, but
because I didn't remember really any other lines.
Really? I mean, the trick is getting them shut up once they start. Like, you know, my God.
Then Walt begins arranging the destruction of the RV, and Jesse shows up, and in that moment, Walt realizes, oh my God, if Jesse's here, Hank must be here too. So he starts closing up the RV, closing all the windows, closing the blinds, closing the doors, and then he hunkers down, tries to ride out the storm.
Before we get to this, I really like the scene of like Walt reminiscing. Like, this was, you know, the Crystal Ship, as it's later called, is a seminal piece of the show, and I felt like that it was appropriate for the main character to take like one last longing, you know, like James Kirk touring the Enterprise before it gets scuttled.
Yeah.
You know, like you trail your hands over the mm-hmm. cabinets and look how primitive the cooking devices was. And like, this is where it all began. And then like, oh, fucking Funyuns.
Yeah, no, it's interesting though, because like it would be similar if, you know, the Enterprise had ruined James Kirk's marriage, right? If like it had destroyed his family, but yet he still had some sort of affection for it.
It kind of, that's arguable that the Enterprise did.
Was James Kirk ever a family man?
He wasn't. He did father a child with research scientist in the Wrath of Khan, and she intimated that his career is what kept him ever from becoming a thing.
Yeah, so I guess you could say, in a way,
he's also a shitty father, so yeah.
The Enterprise is the call of Captain.
Well, that Jim. And the green girls and the metallic bikinis, and well, like there's a lot
how
of
can you resist?
A lot of things that went into the stew of the Enterprise and the service.
Can you really blame him? Come on.
But yeah, no, I feel like it's very much the feel of like, you know, this is a big piece of my history. This just changed my life forever, and I'm saying goodbye to it.
Yeah. And I wonder if it's also not in the creator of the show's mind, if it's in the Villian's mind, like, this is it.
Oh,
this
the love
the RV,
and care
I want
that
to give
gave.
It a scene.
Oh yeah, the way they did it right, I thought. And you know, it kinda is its own character. And
yeah,
I feel like that they gave it a really nice send off. Mm-hmm. And also, as you said, this is just an epic scene. And
oh, yeah.
It's not like I'm amazed at how a show like Breaking Bad can derive this much tension and this much just like pulse pounding from a relatively mundane moment. You know, there's no shootout. There's no implied threat of physical violence. It's just Hank, the brother, DEA brother-in-law of Walt, is right outside. He's got a hard-on for Jesse already. The fact that Walt's in there, well, I mean, what even happens?
If he opens that door, game over.
Yeah.
Walt's going to prison. The family's going to find out, like...
And then Joe coming out and like getting into some sea lawyering with Hank, and then you know, Jesse being coached by Walt. It's just so good. So
and
good.
The idea that the only thing between Walt and a lifetime in prison probably is this flimsy RV door. Like he's desperately holding onto the handle, hoping Hank can't pry it open.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the law is one thing. Like, let's say, okay, he can't use this evidence or whatever to convict
but
Walt.
But it still blows up his life forever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's more at stake here for Walt than necessarily just life in prison.
Yes.
It's his kids. It's...
It's everything.
It's his entire life, yeah.
Yep.
So, that's one of the reasons it works so well. And the other reason it works is because Jesse is just like, what the fuck do we do? What do we do? Like, he's got... No clue. And it's interesting to see Jesse go from a guy who's blaming Walt for being greedy and saying, I can do this right, to a guy who's relying on him for an idea.
Yeah.
Like, he goes right back to old Jesse mode where he's just this little puppy dog who can't do anything when shit hits the fan.
Yeah. I mean, he really struggles in the big picture stuff at this point. And like the stuff he comes up with, like, we just ran the shit out of his truck. And then it's like, oh. Well, that's a bad idea because I might get shot. I mean,
there's multiple reasons that that's a bad idea.
Yes. Yes, it is.
One of which is getting shot.
From Walt's perspective, he doesn't want Hank to get the shit rammed out of him.
Sure.
Like, he's trying to find a way out of this situation that's going to preserve everyone's life and dignity.
Yeah. And the way he finds out of this is genius.
And you can tell on his face, like, this... is I'm about to do something that's unconscionable.
Yep.
Like, if I, if I'm a recipient of this behavior, I'm going to go nuclear. And that's not counting. Like, I don't think Walt fully appreciates the state that that Hank is in.
I don't think so either. I'm not even sure if he's aware of it. He's got so much other stuff going on.
Sure, sure. That's what I mean. Like, yeah. He's probably like, you know, it's like this. He doesn't understand what a volatile situation as Hank Schrader's deal is. It's pretty bad.
You're right. This is next level. I mean,
and the fact that he already hates Jesse and he thinks Jesse's an idiot, and for him to think that Jesse did this to him, using his knowledge of his family, which is already like I think if you're a criminal that's being surveilled by a cop and you just called a man's wife or left a voicemail for her and said like, hey, you know, just wanted to make sure we're on a first name basis, that's enough for a cop to just beat the piss out of you and take the law into his own hands. The fact that you use this as like a way to get the better of him when he thinks he's smarter than you.
Yeah. He owes Saul one for sure.
Yeah.
And Saul owes his assistant secretary. I forget
what her name. The one with the sweet can.
Yeah. She she works the lobby. But yeah, I don't know, man. This scene is just so tense.
It really is.
This is maybe the most tense scene to date.
Because that's the thing. They got out of it with the private domicile bitch line.
Yeah.
But it just delays the inevitable because Hank's like, all right, I'm just going to wait out here. Yep. So we'll see.
Maybe he would have just fallen asleep in his car anyway.
He's pretty sleepy.
Just give him a couple more hamburgers.
Play Rockabye Baby over the loudspeakers and he's just out like a light.
So Hank gets this phone call. I don't know how much we want to talk about the rest of it, but, you know, he gets a phone call about Marie being in the hospital and he rushes off to see her to try and help. And when he gets there, he realizes what's happened because he gets a phone call from Marie who says, hey, you know, just putting dinner on. He realizes and he's pissed.
I was genuinely moved by him running through that emergency center in just a panic because you can see the one thing that cuts through his obsession with catching, you know, because this, you know, we talked about that this is all kind of, you know, this thing is tied up with his concept of his manhood and his dealing with his PTSD. And like, this case is everything to him, but his wife almost dying gets through to him. And then when he finds out, you know, we hear about these black rages and television, but I think this is one of the most effective portrayals of someone just working up to one. Like when that phone drops and they close in on his face, that's a man who's going to kill somebody.
Easily. Like
whose last name rhymes with Stinkman. It's pretty bad.
We've already seen this guy hulk out on somebody in a bar.
For no good reason at all.
People. For really no reason. Now he's got a reason.
Ugh.
And I mean, going forward, he's got to be a force to be reckoned with.
I would say so.
Just the way he's looking through his eyebrows.
It's clobbering time.
Yeah. Yeah. Then we get a montage of the RV being destroyed, set to some fairly mournful music.
Sure.
I don't know. It's definitely a moment. This is an end of an era.
And Jesse's face, because like Walt is, what do you call it, nostalgic?
Yeah, but he's moved on to better things, right?
But he's got his this is not only Jesse's nostalgia and like the greatest thing he's ever been involved in, but also Walt essentially winning the argument.
Now you have nowhere to cook.
Yeah. And not even like, you know, and also it was all necessary. And he's kind of got to be grateful for it, too. Like, I just thought that Aaron Paul did a great job with just emoting everything that Jesse was feeling watching this be destroyed and ripped apart.
Yeah. And I love that shot where they've got the camera kind of over the top of the crusher and it's shooting Walt and Jesse, but you can't see them until the crusher comes down a little bit.
Yeah.
Revealing their faces. That's pretty cool.
And the inside of the RV as it's getting just rammed by those, you know, poker things, the forklift attachment. It was pretty awesome too.
You got to wonder what Jesse's going to do now. He was all set to start cooking again. He's got Badger and Skinny Pete out on missions to get equipment and such.
Yeah.
Where is he going to cook? Is he going to cook in his basement?
It's already a meth lab, you know, so why not? It's got that stink on it. I don't know because
it's going to scare him off of it.
What struck me about Jesse is, as we talked about, he's not a big picture planner and his plan was essentially to do the same, only more cautious and less reckless. But
yeah.
They didn't have a really great plan. to move meth in quantity, and they didn't have a plan for when like someone rolls tough on them or rips them off, and those problems are still there. So what is he going to do? He's going to sell in Walt and Gus's territory?
Seems like a bad idea.
That's so good. Yeah, if Walt run you off from the local Home Depot, you start doing that shit. I mean,
so then Gus travels into the desert to meet with the cousins, and we find out that they want to kill Walt still. And instead, he says, you know what? I need Walt, but wouldn't you rather have the guy who actually pulled the trigger on Tuco? And he tells him that his name is Hank Schrader.
Yeah, I feel like Gus is whistling past the graveyard when he says, may his death satisfy you. Because if anything, I think it's going to get him stoked for the main course. But
it's
an appetizer. And I also like the cousins, how like their faces are like very intrigued. I'm not sure I buy this whole north of the border and your say versus, you know, who we work for this guy versus working for you.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll take you up on it. Why not?
Yeah. If I'm Gus, why does Gus do this? I understand that he needs Walt at the moment and that that's a priority. But you would think the killing of a DEA agent would also bring a lot of heat.
But it'd be, so it's worth it to him. It'd be heat on the cartel, which
okay
would make, because there's some friction between him and the cartel. You can tell, you can tell there's cartel friction. So I feel like in his calculus that, you know, these cartel guys come north and kill Hank as a revenge for the Tuco stuff, that's going to lead the DEA to step up their war against the cartel, which since he's north of the border and he's this respected businessman, that by default makes his position stronger. And I also wonder if Saul, knowing about Hank being on the trail, somehow got to Mike, who somehow passed it on to Gus, and this is part of the equation too. Like, not only am I going to maybe get some breathing room from these cousins, but this is also going to further, you know, he's the type of guy that makes one move with two outcomes. Yeah. He's protecting his man, Walt, in two different directions from the police and also from the cousins with one stone. So I thought that was, I don't know, pretty, you know, that's a lot of headcanon there, but I thought it is a pretty savvy move.
Yeah, I think taking
the chicken man,
taking out the head of the investigation that is closest to him.
He's the only. Gomi's, you know, checked out to El Paso. He's the only. Like, Merker doesn't believe in this shit.
And you got to imagine Gus might know that, given his relationship with the DEA. Right?
Sure, he's sponsoring fun runs, and I mean, there's a reason he does all that to keep kind of in. So
it's a big question I have about how in he is with the DEA. Sponsoring fun runs, you know, coming in with a bunch of people from other companies is one thing. Does he have any other kind of contacts in there? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But that's it. That's the end of the episode. We fade to black there.
Yeah, we sure do. Should we get into some feedback?
Yeah, let's do it.
If you'd like to send us feedback, two primary ways you can do that. Go to forums.baldmove.com, go to the Breaking Good forum, and there's a thread for every episode that you can have a discussion or comment on there. You can also send in email to breakinggood@baldmove.com. These fellow fans chose the latter method, and first up is Jill G. We got some, you know, as a way we're recording this, we're recording a lot of these. We're trying to get these all recorded before Fear the Walking Dead starts. Mm-hmm. So even though we were going to be releasing these afterwards, we're actually compiling the feedback, you know, sometimes a couple weeks after. So I hope people aren't annoyed that, like, hey, I sent some feedback for this episode and it didn't get read. It might get read a couple weeks later. Anyway, that's how the sausage's made. Here's the result. Jill G said, I'm sorry I didn't get this feedback in before your recap of IFT. I've been waiting forever to get your thoughts on this particular point that most recappers miss. Skyler approaches Ted in the break room and kisses him and asks if his kids are home. It cuts to the next scene, which is Skyler's car pulling into the White House driveway. Cut next to Skyler opening the front door and entering a home with Holly. Did she take Holly along? I assume that since Skyler usually brings Holly to work with her at this point, that her hookups with Ted over lunch or after work include a baby on a carrier in tow. Mm-hmm. Blah. I've had two babies this age, and I cannot imagine bringing one to a first-time hookup or even Ted being cool with it. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, Holly is exceptionally quiet for a baby of that age,
sure,
right? Cries on cue when it's appropriate. But yeah, still A, super creepy.
Sure.
And B, probably, I imagine she's going to be a little fussy.
I mean, I'm a little weirded out having sex with animals in the bedroom. Like a dog or a cat. No, no.
What?
No, like they're just observing. That is silently sitting there in the corner, just observe, just watching you, and like, what the hell?
Yeah.
But they need to get the fuck out for playtime. But, you know, last episode, it seemed like that Skylar was leaving her with Marie.
But before that, the first time it
maybe
happened,
she's definitely. Like, "Hey, I need to run on air." I mean, like. So,
I don't think so, man.
But you think Skylar is going to bring the baby and just park her in the corner? Like, I will say, as a dude that's dated, you know, single moms, you know, that there are those out there that would do something like this. Mm-hmm. And it is skeevy, and I'm not cool with that. I do think Ted is so into sticking it to Skylar that he wouldn't like make it a serious objection.
Uh-huh.
He's kind of like clueless and you know, just thinking with his dick at this point. I don't think Skylar would do it though.
I think she would. I think that first time she does, certainly.
This is the woman that gave a fully clothed hand job to a man while she's on eBay. Like there's a level of uptightness here that I just don't think would allow. Like, I get it. And here's the thing. Like, it's psychologically, your child's brain is kind of mush at this point.
Sure.
And they're not going to remember anything scarring, you know. So, like, I think if you're talking just ethics and morals from a pseudoscientific stand, that you're probably fine. But you're – and, like, you know, there's also the argument that back in the – olden days when people lived in one bedroom houses, like Discovery Channel, you just, you know, hope the kids were still asleep and you just got up to Discovery Channel shit.
13-year-old on the couch and you're back behind him boning.
Yeah.
Just how it goes.
It's just the way, that's the way of the world.
But I think Skylar being out for this impromptu revenge would not stop to drop Polly off. Like, what kind of questions does Marie ask? You know, like, is she going to be like, oh, I'm on my way to this guy's house, but I need to stop by and drop off the baby?
What is this, IFT?
Yeah.
IFOH? In front, like, that's like, in front of Holly? Like, that's just to really twist a knife in Walt's gut?
No, no, no. It has nothing to do with that, but she's not thinking clearly, obviously, right?
Well, she's smoking in front of the baby.
She's smoking while she's got the baby
inside. Yeah, inside, which you can tell, like, is something that she already would not do in her right mind. But it's there. I don't want to say Skylar would do something like that again. After I've already said that it's not that big a deal. It's just,
I think she did.
It's just bad from a Western 21st century civilization standpoint. It's just kind of, you know, inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, I don't. I think she had an emergency session with Marie.
All right.
She's like, I got something that came up.
Disagree.
Are you off work? Okay. That's what I think. I don't know.
She said she took Holly over to Marie's work. Marie set her right next to the X-ray machine while she's working. And then Skylar went off and did her thing.
Just cover the lead blanket. She'll be fine.
No problem.
Scott V, I have a question. In the Horse with No Name episode, Mike calls Gus. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this the first time we learned that Mike just doesn't work for Saul? Surprised you guys didn't talk about that. I feel like we did talk about that, but we might have talked about it like a couple episodes before in a spoiler section.
Yeah,
and
Mike's,
also like
Mike's
last season,
right?
We spent a long time trying to figure out exactly how this all works with the territory. So maybe we felt like we'd already touched on it.
But. Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty apparent that Mike is more of a mercenary than he works for anybody in particular.
Mm.
You know, he's a contractor for hire.
Okay.
And he works regularly with Gus and he works regularly with Saul, but I think he's on his own team for the most part.
Right on. He says, also, I'm tired of everyone saying damn plane crash was Walt's fault. So John DeLancey has no culpability in knowing he was too fucked up by grief to work. We all make choices. My point is, how far back do we go? Let's say, for sake of argument, whatever happened between Elliot, Gretchen, and Walt was indeed Elliot's fault or not an overreaction from Walt. What if Elliot never makes this mistake? Walt is in the 1% and never heard of Jesse Pinkman. So is a plane crash Elliot's fault now? How far back do we go? It's Q's fault. Now, yes, if I was Walt, I would feel guilty for standing there as she died, and I may blame myself. If I was Jesse, I'd absolutely think it was my fault and feel guilty. I get that. but I'm tired of the viewership blaming Walt and or Jesse. If Q would have stayed the fuck home, I wouldn't have had to put up with these damn flash forwards all season that left me with blue balls when all was said and done. That's my rant for the day. You know, that's a pretty fine distinction to make. And
there's plenty of blame to go around.
To the extent that, like, I feel like the show in my second, you know, period of watching and my first period of watching as a podcaster in these first two seasons did a much better job than I would have initially suspected of making it clear that this gray matter thing is kind of Walt's problem. If, like, Gretchen had cheated on him, I mean, that's still not... I mean, the other thing is, like, what do you call culpability? Like, if Gretchen had cheated on Walt with Elliot and Walt had overreacted to the point that he's just going to break up and leave the company and give up all his shares and then marry this, you know, diner waitress and have this life, like, is that really Elliot's fault or even Gretchen's? Like, it's Gretchen's fault that their relationship ended. All those other choices were things that Walt did.
Sure. And I mean, I think that's where I put a little bit of blame on Walt for this, is because Walt made a choice to let Jesse or let Jane die. Right. He, in a mostly clear head, he said, this is happening. I'm going to make this choice. Whereas after the fact, Jane's father is not in a clear state of mind at all. And, like, his choices are going to be suspect. I mean, going back to work is, yes, it's a bad idea for this guy. And it is a choice that he made. But how much do you blame him? I certainly blame him.
So it's like when people want to say, like, alcohol. Like, I was drunk. You can't blame me. It's like, okay.
I still blame you, I understand.
You put your – and plus, you also chose to drink the alcohol in the situation that got you that. So there's also a choice versus
– which John DeLancey did not have that choice.
Versus someone that gets their drink spiked with something.
Yes.
You know, that –
that's a good analogy.
That's a different thing. Like – John DeLancey was going to work, drinking his coffee, not knowing that it was spiked with, you know, LSD.
with extreme sadness.
Yeah, so that's...
and depression.
Yeah, like, he was already effed up from the other actions, and he wasn't thinking clearly. And that's also, you know, that's something people say. Like, you need to get back on, you know, you need to stay busy. That's like, it's not like this is something that is beyond the pale. Him returning to work early is just like, oh, this is just as obviously dangerous behavior.
So, no, I mean, people think they're better off than they are at any given moment, you know?
But what I think is fascinating is how many discussions you can have about the ethics and morality of Breaking Bad and how people are just all over the map. And since it's just pretend, you can take these strong positions with no real repercussion, like, other than people on the internet being mad at you.
And since I can't believe you think Walt's a bad guy.
After doing this for 5 years, the effect of people on the internet being mad at you, not that bad. Not as terrible as it can be.
Yeah, but like I said, I think there's plenty of blame to go around. Everybody is culpable here. I just think some are more responsible than others because of the choices they've made with their heads on straight.
Sure.
Why it comes down on Walt.
Jane owns a little bit of this, but then again, if Jesse hadn't entered her life, you know, she would be just
fine. But she made the choice to do heroin again.
I get it.
Yeah.
But she wouldn't have if she'd never met Jesse. So it's like...
wouldn't she? Who knows?
Well, that's true.
Who can say?
That's you're exactly right. That's your, because she is a recovering addict and she's 18 months sober, but if she falls for the wrong person again, who knows? Who knows?
Yeah.
Or she just decides she's, you know, fed up with life.
I blame everyone. I blame the pilots most of all.
Yeah, man. What the fuck?
Come on. You don't, I blame the government. Coming?
Those 1960s technology air traffic controls, come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
Really, who wrote that database system?
It's not anybody competent.
There should be safeguards.
The lowest bidder is who wrote that system.
You're absolutely right. I blame the government.
Yep. all right. That's it for feedback. Again, if you'd like to send us more, you can do at breakinggood@baldmove.com or on forums.baldmove.com. We have some spoilers. I actually have a lot. What's interesting is this season I'm doing less of the look at this abstract thing that you don't notice and more of just like, I keep feeling like I'm going to run out of these, but I keep coming up with like almost essay level things to just talk about for the characters and stuff, because we are in such a pivotal epoch of the show. Mm-hmm. Epoch.
Era.
Era, sure.
That's easier to say.
Yeah.
easier to pronounce. I'm
trying to think, it's APOC in the Matrix, but that could just be some weirdo hacker pronunciation.
Sure. All right. Well, if you're into spoilers, I guess stick around after the music. And if not, we'll see you next week. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See ya.
And we're back with the spoiler section. What do you got?
It's funny because I wrote like three of these things down just when we were discussing it. But you asked, how is into the DEA is Gus?
Yeah.
And I think back of the aftermath of season four and Merker sitting there in his office looking at this picture of him going fishing on Gus's boat. And
realizing, oh, my God.
And being at the barbecues and talking about how much time he spent. And I'm like, I could see Gus in his quiet little way getting him to talk about the problems inside a department and like, you know, one manager to another.
Yeah.
This reminds me of the time where my fry cook refused to drop the fries at the right time. And he's like, yeah, and I got this Hank guy who refused his position of, and yeah, I think he probably had his thumbs up that pie more than we suspect.
Seems like it. He had a pretty chummy relationship with some of those guys in there.
So, I mean, that's kind of spoilery, but yeah, I feel like Merker at least felt like he had been had.
Yeah.
How do you feel about this? Is the start of Dead Man's Brew?
It is. It totally is. Well, we didn't get to it till season four, obviously, but
sure,
it hangs around. Like, you can see why Dead Man's Brew was a thing, right?
Yeah. I was kind of surprised. I mean,
it hangs around for a full season at least.
Sure. Sure.
So,
Season and a half, if you say the Dead Man's Brew counter starts right now. If you're not familiar, yeah. Jim had this crazy theory in season four. One of his predictions, I think, was that there was a level of coffee in this thing after Gale dies that keeps getting lower. And he's like, there's going to be some apocalyptic event that happens when they run out of the brew.
Yeah, it never happened.
No, I'm pretty sure Walt just knows how to brew coffee with the apparatus. He's, you know,
he's a chemist.
Also, do you think this is the start of Walt? Because eventually Walt moves into the buying Junior's affection. He becomes the Disneyland dad or the drug dealer equivalent.
Yeah.
I'm going to pay cash for a charger for you, son. And I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. Do you think this is the start of that? That change in relationship? Because for the first time, he's feeling some heat from Junior for this. He's starting to feel some mm-hmm. of, he's having to own some of his problems here and he doesn't like it.
Yeah, and like I said in the recap, he's coming to terms with kind of the new relationship he's going to have with his family.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe that idea is kind of percolating.
The high road channel is closing down for him, so he needs a new path. I thought that this is maybe the start of that, where he has to have a new tack to kind of fight Skyler.
Yeah, to talk a little bit more about Gale and kind of the role that he plays later on in the series. I'm trying to figure out how much of this is on the screen at this point, but Gale is clearly there to replace Walt, to learn from Walt and replace him once the 3 months are up.
Sure.
And who knows if Gus is going to kill Walt. I think Gus would probably kill Walt after those 3 months.
I agree.
Disappear him, melt him in a barrel, something. Mm-hmm. So Gale, like, I'm looking for the signs in these next few episodes.
The only problem with that theory is knowing Gale the way we do and knowing Gus the way that he knows Gale, apparently. Mm-hmm. I feel like if they had this beautiful 3-month cook and Gale learns everything from him and he gets replaced, doesn't you think Gale has a problem with that?
Unless,
because I feel like Gale
goes out like, okay, this is it. I'll see you later. If he can get Walt to disinvest in this operation.
Maybe if Gus says, look, just it's important that I know you and Gale are friends and you're going to want to have barbecues and stuff, but for the security of your operation and the safety of your family, you have to tell Gale this is it, this is goodbye.
Yeah. And I think Walt, out of respect for this guy, would want to say goodbye.
Yeah, and then out of respect for Walt, he'd do that, and then he gets shot, and then Gale, he just thinks that Walt, I guess, yeah. There's lots of different ways that could have gone down without Gale being any the wiser.
Yeah, he just thinks Walt's moved on.
And also,
not to another life.
Gale, you know, if he finds out that Gus killed Walt, is Gale the kind of guy that's going to, you know, mount up on that? Or is he going to like, I'm just going to keep cashing my checks and hope I don't get replaced?
I think that's probably Gale.
Yeah, he's a much more easy to control thing.
Yeah.
But And you know, we see in a flashback later on, I think it's early in season five, that Gale's respect for Walt's process is what gets him killed. Because, you know, he's setting up the super lab and creating all this equipment, and Gus is like, everything's to your satisfaction. He's like, oh, yeah. And he's like, but Gale's like, you know, I just can't cook this level of purity. And Gus is like, what level of purity can you cook to? And he's like, that's fine. This is meth.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Gale's the one that says, you set up the super lab. Don't you want the best? I mean, you clearly want the best of the best. Don't you want the best of the best? If you want the best of the best, we need this Heisenberg guy.
Yeah.
Gale is signing his own death warrant here because of his fucking love for the purity and the process and the fact that he wants to get to know this guy.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's a big part of it too. Like, they become friends, you know? I feel like it comes a little bit more from Gale's side, because Gale has some kind of immense respect for Walt, but, you know, Walt also has respect for this guy, and it's kind of a sad moment when he has to kill Gale.
Sure.
Because you know he doesn't want to do it.
It's a dark moment in Breaking Bad history.
It's desperate, of course, but he also doesn't want to do it. And, like, Gale doesn't deserve it. Like, all of these things that just come together during Gale's death.
I think it's interesting. This whole season is very clockwork. Like, yeah. No one makes an authentic choice. Because, as we discussed, I think that once...
Walt going back...
But... Here's the thing.
I don't know that he would have survived if he had made another choice.
That's what I'm saying.
But he does make a conscious choice to go back.
He does, but the choice doesn't matter. Because if he says no, I think Gus kills him.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So I feel like this is a season where everyone does the thing that they're going to do. And it is very, like, pool. Everything just lines up like the perfect pool shot. And you're just watching... You're watching all these things just fall like dominoes.
It feels, I guess, as you're watching this, all of the motivations are so clear, and all of the elements that are coming together, it feels almost elemental the way that it plays out. And, you know, having what are they called? The shots where everything. You watch a lot of stuff happen real fast, not montages.
The quizzical clappy
time lapse.
Nyquil squaddle.
Quetzalcoatl? Quetzalcoatl? I don't know.
You don't even remember how to pronounce it now.
No, I don't. It's been too long. Having all of these time lapse shots kind of gives me that feeling. It evokes that feeling of, like, there's nothing that can be changed here. It's all just going to play out how it's going to play out. And those are little slices of, like, I don't know, just that happening in a micro.
It's very
cosmic.
Sunrise, sunset from Fiddler on the Roof.
Okay.
It's interesting because I think watching this for the first time through, I was thinking like, oh, well, Walt just misplayed this, or if only he had done this. But now, knowing what we know about Gus later on, there's a much less choice. And then season four becomes more about how Walt just misplays the situation in his hand.
Yeah, no, and I meant to talk about this in last episode's spoiler section, but you can see the kind of person that Gus is being the ultimate foil for Walt, right? Mm. Up till now, he has dealt with the Tucos of the world and the Crazy Eights, the guys who aren't really thinking that hard about what they're doing.
Yeah.
Whereas Gus is playing Walt like a fiddle here. I mean, last episode, the way he just mind tricks him into coming back to work.
Yeah.
That is the ultimate bane for Walt. That is the one thing that he is not necessarily prepared to contend with. And we see him throughout season four struggling with that, right? Like, how do I get one over on a guy who is like me but better at it?
And not only that, but, man, Walt is so blind to how easily he is to be manipulated. And Walt is such – Walt's kind of a bad manipulator because he's just very naked and in your face about it.
He is, yeah.
But it's super effective because the stakes he's got are so high. And also, one of the reasons that Walt is so good is because he's got cancer. He knows he's going to die, so he will take insane risks that a normal person in normal circumstance. Like, Gus will not
that's
take
true.
The risks he will.
That's
Even
not,
Jesse,
that's
you can
that's
see
not talked
it
about
like,
much.
You're an old dude with cancer. You're going to die. I'm just starting my life, and I, you know, like, it's already fucked up enough. I feel like that's one of the reasons that yes, he's smart. Yes, he's resourceful. Yes, he thinks quick on his feet, but he's also damn lucky.
Yes.
And the reason he can afford to be that reckless is because of the situation he's in. And that's almost a superpower for him.
Yeah. Especially now that he's made the money he needs to make, right? Mm. Now he can be kind of extra reckless.
He's playing with like house money. Like, yeah. I've already done my primary objective, so I can, you know, take crazy risks. But I also think it's interesting because Walt, you know, we've talked a lot about how Walt shits on Jesse, and certainly he does, but he also takes a lot of risks for him. Like, he feels some sense of fatherly responsibility, and you see how much pleasure he's getting from dealing with Gale and Gus, and the fact that he has to blow, like, it gives us a taste of what he's going to miss when he blows this up to save Jesse's life.
Yeah. Yeah, he pays a cost to help Jesse out, which is the true sign of how he feels about him, right?
But the other thing I was thinking as I was writing some of these questions down is I was starting to remember other moves that are made later in season three, and I started thinking, you know, now that I've got this whole new appreciation for Gus, and I've got this theory of, like, this is kind of a clockwork universe we're seeing, is like, you know, when that kid gets killed, which triggers off, you know, Jesse going off the reservation. I wonder if Gus didn't engineer that. He says he instructed his people not to use children and all that stuff. But what if, knowing that he knew that that's what would set Jesse off, and he was trying to come up with a pretext for squeezing him out of the operation?
I'm trying to remember exactly what was happening around that time. Because as I recall, we hadn't met Gus yet, obviously.
No, I'm talking about in the future. When, because, you know,
you're not talking about the kid shooting combo?
No, I'm talking about later on when that kid gets killed himself.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. All right.
And that fucks up Jesse.
Maybe so,
and he goes off half-cocked. I mean, just like, we didn't talk
about... There's so much going on with Jesse and Mike and Gus.
And that's the other thing, is we didn't talk about this because it's a spoiler, but you're talking about, like, all the different moves that Gus is making here involving the cousins. One of the obvious things of sicking him on a DEA agent is that he's a cop, and he's got a gun, and he's got training, and he's already killed one of them. Mm. So what if the cousins get clipped? Like... this is such like a huge gambit for Gus. Like, he could win three separate battles with this one move, and it cost him nothing. I thought that was really, you know.
Yeah, I'm trying to consider the consequences because we know how it goes.
Yes.
And we know that it mostly works out for him.
If anything, Gus underestimates Walt. He underestimates the lengths he will go to. Because I think that, you know, once Jesse goes off reservation, Gus is thinking, this is game over. You know, Walt's going to give up Jesse. He didn't suspect that he was going kill Gale.
Yeah, he misjudged the loyalty that Walt has.
And that's when Gus really reveals his true face. When the first time Walt outmaneuvers him.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, I don't know how much of this is part of Gus's plan or not, but the wedge that Gale should have created between Walt and Jesse was much more powerful than it actually was, right?
Yeah.
Like, Gale is there both to learn Walt's methods and, I think, as a backup plan to kind of drive this wedge between Jesse and Walt. When Walt sees what a capable assistant Gale is, he's going to turn tables on Jesse, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And be completely loyal and cook for me for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, maybe I just have to, really, because that's
exactly.
You know, I think in Gus's mind, having that insurance, like, what happens if Gale dies? Do you get Victor in there to start learning behind him? Like, having two top level chemists that can back each other up, and what if one of them gets sick?
Yeah.
You know, like, I feel like maybe Walt isn't dead at the end of his 3 months, and maybe what Gus's preferred plan was that he'd have two chemists in his stock.
I think so. Walt's dead if he walks away.
Sure.
But I think he survives if he says, yeah, I'll cook for another 6 months. I'll cook for another 5 years.
We're all cooking
definitely.
Yeah. Because then, you know, Gus has got his backup.
Yeah. And I think that's part of the plan. He wants to ingratiate Gale into Walt's influence here.
Which, again, it really speaks highly of Gus's plans, because they're wheels within wheels all the time. He wins when he loses.
And I think that's warranted to kind of see the wheels that we don't necessarily, that aren't super prominent.
And they're not exactly spelled out, yeah.
Because of the way that things go in the future. We know that Gus is that kind of man.
And we really only get, especially in season three, we don't get Gus's side of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, in season four, we get a little bit more because Jesse gets into that, and that's kind of his vector into that, and Mike.
Yeah.
But we don't really ever get to hear him give, like, monologues about what his grand scheme plan is going to be. We have to piece it together. But, yeah, I'm getting a more nuanced appreciation for Gus. Like, I felt like in season four, a lot of Gus was kind of retconning and like, okay, well, we'll take what Giancarlo gave us, but maybe that's true. But man, in retrospect, there's a lot. He's like a criminal genius right off the bat.
Yeah. There's a reason why he's such a big dealer. No one's found him out.
Yeah. And I tell you what, it was cool to see the Breaking Bad wind up so beautifully, but Gus is the best villain this show ever had. Like, the neo-Nazis are a significant drop in interest and quality.
Uh-huh.
Like, Mike is an interesting foil in season five, but once he's gone, it's like, yeah.
I mean, there's like Declan. Declan's not a good villain.
No.
Lydia? Lydia's not a real villain.
No.
None of those people are.
I mean, I'm not saying that I'm not saying that I didn't appreciate the last season of Breaking Bad and it wasn't phenomenal television.
But it's different. It's not about, like, who is he going to fight next. It's about, is he going to get out of this?
But I'm still saying that if Breaking Bad signed off at the end of season four with I won, it still goes down as the greatest show in television and one of the most beautiful endings, period.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if they planned it that way. I don't know.
I feel like they had the juice to go for it another season.
I think so.
But that was like a really bold move. Like, and I remember I was talking about it. Like, when you end things so beautifully and then you come back to end it again, like, that's really a ballsy move. And again, it paid off because, you know, Breaking Bad really exploded in terms of popularity and they nailed the landing. But I don't know, Gus, I feel like season three and season four, it might be peak Breaking Bad.
I agree.
Season five is a continuation of that with higher stakes and less interesting villains.
Yeah, it almost feels like...
And really, it's the Hank. I guess, do you prefer the duel between Hank and Gus or Hank versus Walt?
I mean, I don't know. I view season four as a Walt versus Gus.
That's what I'm saying. Season five was...
Oh, you said...
And really, so it goes... So season three versus four...
Yeah.
Is essentially Walt versus Gus.
Mm-hmm.
Season 5A is Walt versus Mike.
Yeah. Yeah.
For the battle of Jesse's soul.
5B
and
season 5B
is Walt versus Hank.
I mean,
and
the Walt versus Hank moment is so amazing.
Yeah.
That it almost makes the season by itself,
right?
Frankly. Just the lead up to that.
Sure.
To Ozymandias.
Plus, that brings in all five seasons worth of history into that final battle, which elevates it and makes it just like very operatic. But it's damn hard to beat Gus Fring. Gus Fring is just a terrific, terrific character.
I agree.
One other thing, we meet Joe for the first time. He's like upgraded Coover or whatever the hell his name is.
He's a genius with electromagnets.
Larry Hankin, who has made a career playing weirdos.
Yeah.
Did you suspect he'd become a relatively important recurring character?
No.
I mean, he's essentially Walt's, what do you call that? Like, you know, he's his Q.
Okay.
James Bond equivalent to Q.
Yep. He comes up with the gadget to...
He's the Bonnie to
erase hard
to
drives.
Michael Knight, you know. He comes up with all the... Uh-huh. He's the gadget guy. You know, if you need a giant ass electromagnet or some, you know, a RV crushed and dismantled, that's Joe's the guy you see.
Yeah, I assumed he was going to be like the guy who owned the lot where the RV was being stored before.
I didn't get a chance to listen to the Insider cast. I wonder if Joe was a reference to Pulp Fiction's Monster Joe.
I don't know.
Because he's the guy that runs the junkyard that gets rid of questionable things in there. And
yeah,
we never get to meet Joe. We just meet Joe's daughter.
That's right. Yeah, maybe. Villigan likes his pop culture.
And he does like the Tarantino stuff. I know he's done some visual styles and stuff to ape him. So I think...
For sure.
Maybe I'll listen to that and then give a report later on. But yeah, that's all we got.
All right, cool. Well, then I guess we'll see everybody next week.
Yep.